Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, Lieutenant Governor Wyman, and my fellow state officials, ladies and gentlemen of the General Assembly and honored members of the judiciary, members of the clergy, and all the citizens of our great state, thank you. Thank you for the privilege of inviting me into the People's House. Let me offer my sincere congratulations to those of you taking on new and important leadership roles, as well as those who have been reelected into leadership positions. I also want to congratulate the new members sworn in earlier today. I look forward to working with all of you. Let me note that since we were last here together, we have lost some dear friends, including Mary Fritz and Betty Bokas, both of whom served in this House. Our hearts are heavy as we continue to mourn their passing. As always, let us thank Connecticut's brave men and women serving our nation around the globe and pray for their safe return. Thank you as well to my dear friend and the best lieutenant governor in the country, Nancy Wyman. And finally, I had to find her. And finally, thanks to my wife, Kathy, my son, Daniel, and my two other sons for their love and support. Great to have Kathy and Dan here. Thank you. The Connecticut General Assembly met in special session. You met to take historic action in support of our state's economy and our incredible workforce. The legislation you voted to support and that I signed into law protected 8,000 jobs at Sikorsky Aircraft. Equally important, it shored up thousands of more jobs up and down Sikorsky's supply chain and across every corner of our great state. It nearly doubled their spending with local suppliers to almost $700 million per year over the next decade and beyond. I want to thank all of you for that, all of you who participated in that special session. But I also want to remind you that in recent years, we've secured similar investments from United Technologies and Electric Boat. Taken together, these agreements cement our leadership in advanced manufacturing around the globe. A decade ago, if any of us had told our constituents that in 2017, not only would Electric Boat be ramping up their production rather than winding it down, not only would Pratt & Whitney be planning to put thousands of more people to work in our state, but that Sikorsky would be committed to Connecticut for another generation to come, well, they wouldn't have believed us. They would have told us that we were overly optimistic at best and naive at worst. And yet, here we are today. Working together, we have turned what many once considered an impossibility into a reality. Together, we've protected Connecticut's aerospace and defense industry for a generation and likely beyond. But more importantly, we've given these employers and the tens of thousands of employees who work for them something that is vital in today's world. We have given them predictability. We know that predictability creates confidence, and we know that confidence creates growth. When we give people reasons to believe that their job is here to stay, we're giving them the confidence to purchase a home, or buy a new family car, or to start a college fund. In other words, we're giving them confidence to take part in our state's economy. And it's equally true for their employers. Predictability allows businesses to expand, to make new hires, to put down new roots right here in Connecticut. That is what companies and their workers are looking for. They deserve it, and it is on us to provide it. That's what I want to talk to you about today, about what we've done in recent years to make our budget more predictable and our economy more sustainable, and about how we can continue that important work this legislative session. Now, I'm going to discuss three key areas that I believe we should focus on this year. We do this in order to balance our current budget, but also to continue our progress towards long-term prosperity. Now, the good news is that for each of these three areas, positive change has already begun. To start, we need to continue making state government leaner and more cost-effective. The responsible way to do that is by setting priorities and allocating our resources where they are needed most. Because the truth is, we simply can't afford to continue doing everything we've done in the past. In recent years, commissioners and state employees have been hard at work finding creative ways to continue providing essential services while also saving money. These cuts were not painless. Important work had to be phased out so that other vital services could continue. But the results are plain to see. Last year, we cut nearly $850 million out of the budget to bring our current fiscal year in balance. In so doing, we spent less in the general fund than we had in the previous year for the first time since 2002. We've reduced the number of state agencies by 28% since 2011, shrinking from 81 agencies down to 58. During that same time period, we've reduced the size of our executive branch workforce by 9.5%. We now employ 5,000 fewer full-time employees than we did in 2008. And don't let anyone tell you that these reductions are only in frontline employees. We've reduced the number of management positions in state government by 28%. While we had to go through the unfortunate but necessary process of layoffs last year, the vast majority of these reductions have come through attrition. We are also spending less on overtime. With your strong partnership and encouragement, overtime costs dropped 14.5%, saving the state $37 million. All told, excluding higher education, the executive branch workforce is at the smallest it has been since Ronald Reagan was president. And now, in this biennium, we need to continue that work, ensuring we reduce spending responsibly and with great care. Commissioners will need once again to work with their staffs and with you here in the legislature, our partners, to find additional savings. Now, like families across Connecticut, just because we've responsibly managed our budget in recent years does not mean we get to take a year off. We must continue to live within our means, spending only as much revenue as we have and no more. In September, my administration asked agencies to begin thinking about what additional cuts would mean. Having further explored these options, many of their recommendations will be included in the budget that I present to you next month. Cuts in specific areas or outright eliminations should not be taken to mean that certain work is not valued. It simply means that we can no longer afford to do it all, and that our spending must be focused on the very core and essential services for our residents. And to be clear, saving money isn't just about cutting line items or reducing headcount. Agencies will continue to modernize systems, reduce waste, and increase productivity in order to cut costs as much as possible before impacting services or the valuable employees who provide them. Together, we can continue to make state government more efficient, more sustainable, and more reflective of our economic reality. The second area that I'd like to talk to you about today are the obligations we have to Connecticut state workers, educators, and retirees. Connecticut state pension systems were created 80 years ago, but not a single dime was deposited into the account during the first 30 years of its existence. It was a pay-as-you-go system. Now, over many decades, legacy costs, insufficient contributions, lower than assumed returns, and early retirement packages left us with a significant unfunded liability in the state's employment and teacher retirement systems. The stark reality is that after 80 years, the state has set aside only one-third of the money necessary to responsibly fund its obligation. Let me put that in context. Of the $1.65 billion that we will pay next year to the state's retirement system, 78% of that, nearly $1.3 billion, is what we're paying to make up for what past administrations and past legislatures failed to do. Simply put, our generation is paying for Connecticut's past mistakes. Is that frustrating? Of course it is. Is it necessary? Absolutely. It's also the right thing to do. Our state retirees dedicated their lives and careers to public service. We need to pay them the pensions that they were promised. Let's also acknowledge and thank today's state workers for their efforts in support of Connecticut's residents and businesses. In 2011, we worked at the bargaining table to help put Connecticut on a more sustainable fiscal path. Together, we changed benefits, reduced longevity payouts, restructured state pensions, raised the retirement age, and required all employees to pay for a portion of their post-employment benefits for the first time. We saved the state $1.6 billion on our unfunded liability in the immediate 2 years following that agreement, and a total of $21.5 billion over the following 20 years. Had we not realized that level of savings, our current $1.5 billion projected deficit would be much, much worse. Since making this agreement in 2011, the state has honored its commitment to fully fund the pension obligation each and every year. We are finally doing together what should have been done over the prior 80 years, and I want to thank all of you for that. Building upon these years of work, my administration recently came to a crucial agreement with our state employees and our retirement commissioners, an agreement which will make our pension payments more affordable and, yes, more predictable. Independent analysts are taking note. Moody's Investor Service, a national credit rating agency, deemed this to be, and I quote, a credit-positive step for our state. And the plan's actuaries say these changes will, and I quote again, enhance the stability of our pension system. I urge you to support these important reforms. Now today, despite all of the hard work and real progress, it's clear we have much more work to do to make our short and long-term labor obligations more affordable. Fixed costs continue to increase every year, hampering our ability to maintain vital public services. Pension obligations for both state employees and teachers are on track to cost the state an additional $360 million in the next fiscal year compared to this current year. Clearly, the fiscal challenges we face during the next biennium are very real. In the weeks ahead, my administration will continue working with labor leaders to find solutions for bringing employee costs in line with our economic reality. These talks have so far been frank and direct, and I'm appreciative that state workers are taking part in them. It's very hard, but we must reach an agreement on how to make our pension and benefits more affordable. As we face these fiscal challenges together, we must work together. We must recognize that a responsible and balanced solution to our budget problems is one that includes state employee concessions. Those changes can and should be reached respectfully and at the bargaining table. Our state must honor its legal obligation to our public servants and state retirees, while at the same time keeping our promise to Connecticut's taxpayers. Here's another promise. We will not remake the poor decisions of the past. We will not saddle future generations with fiscal cliffs and unpaid fixed costs. Responsible changes must be made, and they must be made this year. As our past record demonstrates, when we come together and hold realistic expectations and seek common ground, we can deliver results, and we should do so this year. the third and final area that I would like to focus on with you today is how we go about distributing aid to our towns and our cities, primarily how we fund public education. The state provides a total of $5.1 billion in municipal assistance. Municipal aid is more than one-fifth of our overall budget this year, making it the biggest single expense. Not state employee pensions, not Medicaid, not debt service, not salary and benefits of employees. Town aid accounts for the largest portion of our state budget. So it simply would not be fair for us to talk about continued state agency reductions or talk about the need for labor concessions without talking about new ways to provide town aid. Of the $5.1 billion distributed to municipalities, 81% of that, or $4.1 billion, is educational funding. That doesn't include school construction financing, which accounts for approximately one quarter of Connecticut's bonded debt. Now that I've put what we spend in context, let me say this. Of course, Connecticut should be spending lots of money on local education. We all believe that investments in education are a down payment for our state's future. Our budget must reflect those values. But the question is whether, in this time of scarce state resources, are we spending this money in the best way possible? Are we ensuring that all students, regardless of life circumstances into which they are born, regardless of what town or city they live in, can receive a quality public education? I do not believe that we are meeting that standard. And I will point out to you that a recent court decision says that as well. It's why I have long advocated that we direct our support to those municipalities that are struggling the most, so that we can level the playing field for our students and our taxpayers. While we have made progress on this front in recent years, I still believe we have not gone far enough. Connecticut needs a new way to calculate educational aid, one that guarantees equal access to quality education, regardless of one's zip code. Our state constitution guarantees it, and our moral compass demands it. We need a formula that appropriately measures a given community's burden, a formula that recognizes the specific challenges faced by local property taxpayers, and a formula that takes into account the impact those challenges have on the education provided to our children. It's that simple. The budget that I will present to you next month will outline a more equitable system for providing town aid. It will be based on the local property tax burden, on student need, and current enrollment. The system will be designed to be more fair, more transparent, more accountable, and more adaptable, meaning that it will provide flexibility to fit the needs of given communities. The results will be a fairer distribution of our state's limited funds. And if we are successful in this effort, there will be an important ancillary benefit. We can help ensure that no Connecticut city or town will need to explore the avoidable path of bankruptcy. To be clear, that kind of help should not come without strings attached. If a state is going to play a more active role in helping less affluent communities, in helping higher taxed communities, part of that role will be holding local political leadership and stakeholders to a substantially higher standard and greater accountability. Let me be very clear to greater accountability than they have been held to in the past. We should do it so that increased aid doesn't simply mean more spending on local government. Those are the steps that I believe we need to take on town aid funding. The budget I propose next month will lay out a detailed path to getting there. Now, based on prior experience, I can assume that the proposal I put before you will not exactly be the one I get back on my desk a few months later. I understand it. That's how it works. But I am ready to partner with you. But understand this. Real change needs to be made, and it needs to be made this year. Change that leads to a better, more equitable system of town aid, For the sake of our collective future, there is no reason to wait, so let's get to work. Now, I began today by talking about our recent historic partnership having to do with Sikorsky. But of course, it's not just about the aerospace industry. Regardless of region, employment, or income, people in every industry and at every income level are counting on us to get it right. A family in Farmington, where both parents work in the insurance industry, deserves the reassurance of a stable business climate, one that keeps their jobs here in Connecticut. A math teacher in Norwalk should have the peace of mind that her pension and benefits will be intact when she retires after decades of work. A new London High School graduate, following his father's footsteps building submarines here in Connecticut, is owed a stable job with livable wages, enough to buy a home and raise a family. Now, if you don't think we can do it for these people, or for that matter, for all the people of our state, if you don't think we can help our constituents and make their lives and their careers more positive and more predictable, I ask that you look no further than the progress that we have made together in recent years. To see exactly what is possible when Connecticut works together. Now, years of good economic development are helping to grow jobs in our state. In fact, since the end of the Great Recession, we have recovered 85,000 jobs. Through the Small Business Express program, a program that did not exist a few years ago, we have helped more than 1,600 companies, and they've retained 18,000 jobs, good jobs, and they are now creating even more jobs. And in the Manufacturing Assistance Act, we have already helped 150 companies since 2011. They have retained 34,500 jobs and are growing 8,500 more as we speak. All told, unemployment is now at 4.7%. That is the lowest level since 2007. Low unemployment is good. In 2012, we worked across party lines and passed comprehensive education reforms. And today, thanks to great teachers and principals, our students are some of the best readers in the country. And after years of decline, our graduation rates have risen for 5 years in a row. Those graduation rates are now at the highest point in Connecticut's history. We've made monumental advancements for our most vulnerable children in Connecticut as well. Many people have doubted that we would finally be in a position to resolve the 25-year-old Juan F. case, which has kept DCF under federal oversight. For too long, this has been an embarrassment to our state and an unacceptable situation for our children. But today, as I stand before you, the end of that federal oversight is within our reach. We are finally ready for Connecticut state government to reclaim its responsibility for Connecticut kids. So please join me in support of this progress as well. We are also improving our transportation system as we speak. Thanks to investments we've made, the on-time and on-budget completion of the Q Bridge project means that on a daily basis, 140,000 motorists are getting to where they need to go with greater ease. And with Connecticut Fast Track, more people are riding Connecticut Transit buses to work, exceeding all initial projections. Average ridership on Fast Track is as high as 19,000 people per weekday. And finally, on the criminal justice front, Connecticut is leading the nation in reforms. It is now safer than it has been in 50 years. Our prison population has dropped significantly, and I want to underline this, high risk violent offenders are serving more of their sentence than they have ever served before under any other governor. and recidivism has declined substantially as well. This progress has allowed us to save the taxpayers $70 million in the current fiscal year. All of this work, all of it, is making Connecticut a better, more desirable place to work and to live. I need to do one other thing now, because I would be remiss if I don't take a moment to stress the importance of predictability and stability in the wake of November's presidential election. Now, I have no desire to rehash or reanalyze the results. We all get plenty of that from cable news. But I do want to offer two brief thoughts on what we can learn from November and how it might impact the work we have to do this session. First, it is now more clear than ever that too many Americans feel disconnected from their government. They feel the system isn't working for them. They fear that they aren't able to take part in the American dream. While we might disagree on the role of government in that effort, on whether it should be more government or less government, more active or less active, I offer to you that a greater degree of predictability in government, in all government, at all levels, will help reengage and reinvigorate our democracy. Second, regardless of our party or who you voted for, most of us can agree that the presidential transition has been nothing if not unpredictable. It has left some people and some communities feeling anxious and uncertain, and that is true here in Connecticut. But let me remind you, our state has a long legacy of acceptance, compassion, and fairness. So regardless of whether your family settled here in Connecticut 300 years ago or just 3 days ago, you are welcome here. So let me say that as the people of Connecticut navigate a changing national landscape, we will ensure that every state resident is treated with dignity and respect, and we will do this together. And that will not change, not now and not ever. This year, here in Connecticut, we must focus on these historic strengths as we also work to make our budget and our economy more vibrant. We must continue progress together. I'm asking for your partnership. I'm asking that we approach this session and this budget in a spirit of authentic bipartisan collaboration. Next month, I'm going to come back to you with more details on the topics that I have laid out today, about how government should continue to become smaller and more effective, about how we can continue working with our partners in labor to create sustainable benefit systems that we can afford not just now, but in the years ahead, and about why we should find a fair way to fund public education so that we can ensure dollars are going to where they are needed most. All of this will be geared towards building a more predictable budget and a more sustainable Connecticut economy. We are in this together, and together we shall prevail. Thank you. May God bless you. May God bless the great state of Connecticut and the United States of America.